Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. The 11th Arkansas Literary Festival opens this week, and as has been the case from the beginning, it's packed with books, authors, poets, readers. To get you in the mood, if you aren't already, my first guest is the multi-best-selling author Catherine Coulter. In her historical romances, there are mysteries, and her FBI series provides satisfying romantic interludes, cleverly and naturally challenging the reader. Very easy to read and enjoy, as equally was she in conversation when we talked a few weeks ago. She has at least two novels hot off the press this year. The one I was given is Bombshell, among the latest FBI whodunits. It may take a few pages to follow the tangled threads, but it's great fun doing so. Every page has a surprise, especially when one set of villains are musicians.
It's interesting because Rafael Salazar, I'm a musician, okay? And my mother was a concert pianist and organist. And so even though I wrote this, I could never reconcile in my gut that he would do that, raised with the Lozano family, you know, because I kept fighting it because of my musical background. Did you buy it?
No, I thought that he was maybe just sort of in his music so involved, but you didn't make him an attractive character right from the beginning. You referred to him as sort of a lizard.
Yeah, a lounge lizard.
And that fixed him. I mean, he was obviously irretrievable.
But I could certainly picture him in one of the cafes in Madrid. All the women and men around him worshiping mm-hmm. him, and he's playing the guitar. I can just picture that, you know?
He was abusing his gift, which is unforgivable.
Yes.
What is your gift? What is your music?
Well, I was raised on classical, but, you know, classical requires practice, which I rarely do now. And it's interesting because when you get to a certain level of proficiency, particularly with the piano, you don't fall below a certain level, mm-hmm. you know? So I don't practice anymore, and I'm at a certain level, and I will usually play popular music now. And
well,
a few classical things that I remember from old days, that's all.
Yeah. I hadn't realized how much you had written. I read a book of yours ages ago. Liked it very much. It must have been, it was one of your FBI ones called Riptide.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was not nearly as expansive as this one. There weren't nearly as many characters in different villainies that you've put into this one. And it's fascinating seeing how you've created this book with the two threads of disaster and death and danger that are sort of bridged by the brother and sister, Griffin and Delcy.
Mm-hmm.
She apparently is where she goes, trouble follows. But
the trouble magnet, yeah.
Yes, but the two of them, he's come for a specific purpose for something else, and she is involved with the something else. But then there's another aspect of the something else. So in the meantime, you have the spanner in the works when this poor young man is found naked and dead at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial, which is another thread of villainy totally unrelated to the other one.
No, normally I do have two mysteries.
Oh, do you?
And occasionally they will connect up. For example, in the book before Bombshell, Backfire, the two plots... I was driving down the highway, and I say, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do this? And I have this epiphany, and the two plots actually tied together perfectly. But normally that can't happen. It just did in that particular book. But I had wanted to do the banking scandal, and, you know, I waited long enough to talk about it. And so that was why basically I had that other plot was because of the banking scandal, those horrible...
Well, reading the background of the characters in your book, I was wondering how close you were treading to the actual facts of whether you were going to be landed on. Well, that you might be confronted with somebody saying, look, you must not do this. It's too close to reality. You're going to be sued or something like
that. Well, I hope it's reality. And I hope that I presented all sides of it because, you know, the Congress was also complicit in it. And then, of course, Palmer Cronin, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, was basically, Greenspan. So, I tried to be accurate. It is accurate. You know, in terms of greedy us wanting a piece of the pie, mm-hmm. in terms of Congress being absolute idiots, in terms of the greed in the banking world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I hope it's true. In one of the books, it was called Whiplash, I went after the pharmaceutical companies, which are the most immoral group. I think they even beat the bankers out. And all of that you find on the Internet. You know, nothing is
hidden
private
anymore.
Here.
Yeah.
We're
but
idiots.
You do have some wonderful characters who are the good guys. And I must say, I do like the fact that you like your heroes and heroines to be beautiful.
Oh, why not? Who wants to read about ugly, you know? Well, actually, Griffin is very special. He appeared in Backfire, the book, last year. And he was in the San Francisco field office. And that's when Sherlock and Savage were out there on this case and worked with him. And then Savage asked him to come back. And that's why he was traveling across the country.
Right.
You know, so he was, he's quite gorgeous.
No.
The others are just pretty, but he was gorgeous.
Yes, and I was going to ask you if the book before this one was his first introduction to your series.
Yes, he appeared for the first time in Backfire. And then he will appear, you know, like little cameos in the future because he's now in the unit, in the
right.
criminal apprehension unit with the rest of the agents.
Now, how far back do Sherlock and Savage go?
Well, Savage, when I wrote the very first book, goodness, Anne, it came out in 1995. It was called The Cove, and Savage played a minor role in that book, and it was meant to be a standalone book. And then, of course, it went just ape on the bestseller list, and of course, the publishing house wanted to know, well, when's the next one? And I said, what are you talking about? They said, well, we want a series. And so I was sitting there thinking, what? And then, I'm not lying to you. I could be, but I'm not. There's this voice in my head that said, Catherine, what about me? And it was Savage. And so in the second book, The Maze, that's really Sherlock's book, and that's when they meet. And, of course, since it's a suspense thriller, you know, they get married off stage. And then in the third book, they've been married like 6 months. But it was not a series until like the fourth book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why still I think I have Sherlock as tall, short, green eyes, blue eyes, Savage with dark eyes. You know, I mean, I didn't approach it correctly, you might say. So I keep trying to go and, clean up the books to make them consistent. But it really wasn't a series until the fourth book.
Interesting. Now, you do have some other little sidebars that I read the first one almost at the very, very beginning, and I thought, now, why is she doing this? You brought in children. And I thought, hostages to fortune, this is something dangerous here, what's going to happen? So all through the book, I thought that something was going to happen to Sean.
No, that was, I wish you hadn't had that angst. Nothing will ever happen to Sean. I already dealt with that in The Target, which was Backfire was about those same people 5 years later.
Uh-huh.
But it was about a little six-year-old girl that a federal judge found sexually abused and physically abused in the forest.
Hmm.
And so that was very, very difficult. And so, no, nothing will ever happen to Sean. And they take very good care. You know, if there's a threat of any kind, he goes over to his grandmother's house,
mm-hmm.
you know, this kind of thing. And there was one other book. It was called Blindside. I think you'd really like that one. We have two children in it, Sam and Keeley. And it starts out with Sam. He's 6 years old, and he's been kidnapped, and then he saves himself. So there's no angst. You know, you see this little kid getting himself together and getting out of there. So, Sean is safe for all time.
Well, that's good to hear. Now, your knowledge of geography, of the places you write about, the caves on the road to Wolf Trap, do they exist? Are they like that? In these caves?
Winkle's Cave, yes. That appeared in another book. Ruth Warnecke and Sheriff Noble.
Yeah.
They appeared in two other books.
But
and
do those...
also, that's where we have Maestro and we have the Stanislaus School of Music, which I cannot tell you how many people have asked me, how do you get in touch with them? Because I'm very interested in attending or my kid attending. And I always feel so sorry saying, I'm sorry, but I made it up. Anyway, I have that whole thing, that's made up. The whole thing is made up.
Okay. So the other thing I was intrigued about was this link with the arts, music. Have you linked them with murder before in other books with different characters?
Sherlock was going to go to Juilliard. She was a concert pianist.
Now, just before I came to the station, I called a friend, and she's a great reader. So I asked her this morning if she'd read anything by Catherine Coulter. Oh, yes, she said. I love them.
But, well, that's lovely.
But she didn't know you wrote romances.
Oh, yeah, I started out with those, with historical romances.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm a history buff.
Well, that's great, because I was brought up absolutely immersed in the books of Georgette Heyer.
Oh, my heavens. She's my goddess. She is my absolute goddess. You know, I grew up with her. I just grew up with her. Well, it's interesting because at a signing, depending on who shows up, the men always, of course, bring the FBI, but the women... I'd say it's 2-1 with the romances because I wrote so many of them.
What, 2 a year?
Oh, many more than, yeah, sometimes 3 a year. Yeah, there were a lot of them. And then tried some contemporary romantic suspense. And the difference between a romantic suspense and a suspense thriller is that in order to be called a romance, you have to have that at the core of the book. And then you can have whatever else you want around it. Whereas in a suspense thriller, it's not the romance, it's the conundrum at the center of the book. So that's the difference between those two subgenres. But the romantic suspense are fun.
Catherine, I don't know how long you're going to be around when you come here, but I hope you'll be at the author party on the Friday. Because I know
we will be, yes. Yeah. So I will get to meet you then, Anne?
I would hope so, yes.
All right. Well, this, you know, when you talk, things just, the time just flies by.
I know it does, unfortunately.
Well, I can't wait to meet you in person, and I'll see you in, what, about 3 weeks?
Yes, and it's going to be... a great thing, because I think our literary festival is marvelous. This will be the 11th since it first started.
About how many people turn out for it?
I don't know. There just seem to be masses, and it's mostly downtown because downtown has been restored like you wouldn't believe since we first came here. And there are wonderful libraries and books and meeting houses and places to eat and just to talk books, which I think is one of the nicest things you can do in the world these days.
Well, I totally agree with you, and I have never been to Little Rock, so this will be exciting. I can't wait to see everything.
Yes, and it's all...
Yeah, we're coming in on Thursday.
It'll be very interesting, because I imagine that the room where you'll be doing your reading and meeting the public will be packed.
And I hope so, Anne. Can you make it so?
Oh, of course. They'll listen to this interview and think, my God, I've got to go and meet her.
Well, I won't be doing any reading. I just talk, and hopefully I'm funny and we have questions and so forth. But if you could make it so, I'd like about, I don't know, a zillion people would be nice.
Well, they have a limited number of square inches in each room, but you'll probably be in the biggest one.
Well, okay, babe. I will meet you on Friday evening then.
That was Catherine Coulter, whose books, sold in millions, are regularly on the bestseller lists. Bombshell is one of her most recent FBI stories, the one which started our conversation. She comes to the Arkansas Literary Festival this week, will be at the author party on Friday, April the 25th, then Saturday the 26th in session at 1 p.m. in the Ron Robinson Theatre on the Cal's campus. Happy to talk about the fine art of suspense. Her book, The Final Cut, in which she introduces a new character, is just out. For more information, visit www.arkansasliteraryfestival.org.
The very thought of you
Some other events this week. In Conway on Tuesday, in UCA's Public Appearances Pop Series, catch Bela Fleck and Chick Corea, 7:30 in Reynolds Performance Hall. In Searcy at Harding University, hear the Chamber Singers at 8 p.m. in Reynolds Recital Hall. In Jonesboro, the Arkansas State University Theater production of Tartuffe runs April 21st through 23rd, 7:30 in the Fowler Center. In Fayetteville's Walton Arts Center, Ramsey Lewis and John Pizzaroli present a tribute to Nat King Cole in Baum Walker Hall. And in the Nadine Baum Studio Theater, the Theater Squared production of Hamlet continues through May the 4th. In Fort Smith, April the 26th, the symphony's 90th anniversary celebration continues with Bonjour Paris, 7:30 in Best Performing Arts Center. And in Eureka Springs Fine Arts Gallery, the exhibit of works by Jody Stevenson is up through April the 28th.
Here's a look at what's happening in the arts in Central Arkansas. Tuesday, the Arkansas Symphony's River Rhapsody Chamber Series ends its season with a concert featuring music by Beethoven and Wagner, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Presidential Center's Great Hall. Thursday, the Chamber Music Society of Little Rock presents the Enso String Quartet, 7:30 p.m., also at the Clinton Center. Opening Friday at the Arkansas Art Center's Children's Theater, Sleeping Beauty, shows on Fridays at 7, Saturdays and Sundays at 2 through May 11th. Ballet Arkansas presents Momentum, Friday and Saturday at 7:30 and next Sunday at 2 at the Arkansas Repertory Theater. The Big Rock Reading Series continues this Friday with poet Charlotte Pence and short story writer Adam Prince, 11 a.m. at Pulaski Technical College's R.J. Wills Lecture Hall, presented in cooperation with the Arkansas Literary Festival. The third annual Thea Arts Festival is Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. in North Little Rock's Argenta District. This year's featured artist is Emily Wood. The Wildwood Academy of Music and the Arts early bird registration has been extended to April 25th. This is the inaugural year for Wildwood Park's Summer Music and Arts Festival for students from elementary grades through college. The final deadline is April 30th. And next Sunday, the Arkansas Symphony presents The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra by Benjamin Britten at Central High School's Roosevelt Thompson Auditorium. The 3 p.m. concert is free and open to the public. On display around town at the Arkansas Art Center, Ties That Bind, Southern Art from the Collection, and ending today, Earthly Delights. At the UALR galleries, Revision, Missing, Listen, Light, Fly, drawings by David Balin. And at the Arkansas Studies Institute, Southern Voices, an exhibit of art quilts, and an exhibition of the Arkansas Printmakers Association. And that's a look at the arts calendar for this week. For more on what's going on in Arkansas, visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org.
Another special event taking place this week is the spring concert presented by the Arkansas Choral Society. This year, it's Mendelssohn's Oratorio Elijah. And director Dr. Kent Skinner is bringing four soloists to join the combined choirs of the Choral Society and the University of Arkansas Monticello Concert Choir, and members of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. Baritone Scott Bearden, who sings the title role, joined Kent Skinner and me by phone recently. He is noted and much in demand for his repertoire, which includes all the great main Verdi and Puccini baritones. Falstaff, in particular, one of his signature roles. I asked Kent Skinner if all four soloists were friends of his.
Yes, they are. They're all friends. And several of them I met through the Knoxville Opera. That would be Scott and Linda and Diana Selesky. Actually, Diana I've known for a long time. She's my younger sister.
Well, you're entitled to know her. Scott, the baritone role, Elijah, you don't seem to have all that many oratorios in your bag of works.
Well, I've made myself my way mostly as a baritone, and really, honestly, a lot of the oratorios fit into a bit more of a bass or bass baritone category. Now, as I start to get a little bit older, I feel a little more comfortable, lower in my voice especially, but Elijah is a... It's deceptively high, I think, too. I think anybody would say it that's sung it. And so I don't feel like it's overly low in the first place, so it just has never come along, to be honest. So I've never had the opportunity to sing it. But
you feel you'll be comfortable in it?
Oh, I am comfortable in it. Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of fun to sing. It's very interesting in that it's somewhat operatic, somewhat oratorio feeling with the recitative and things like that. But it also sometimes has almost a leader-like feel about it. And so it's an interesting piece. It has a wide range of sort of musical style to it, I think. So it's interesting.
And it was written, Mendelssohn wrote it for English, didn't he? The original composition.
Sorry?
The original composition of Elijah was written to an English text, was it not?
Well, it was translated into English for the first performance.
Oh, okay.
Which happened in London. And it premiered in English, and so it's very common to do it in English when it's done for an English-speaking audience.
So that's what it'll be here.
Right. Uh-huh.
I've wondered also, we had the Verdi Requiem here a couple of weeks ago where the Arkansas Symphony and massed choirs did it, and we were talking about the way it was written so operatically. And I wondered if that was another aspect of Elijah that fell comfortably for an opera baritone, that there were aspects of the actual writing for the voice that was comfortable for you because it felt familiar, as it were, other than for a church piece.
I think that's one of the things that's interesting about a piece like Elijah. If you went through the history of recordings of a piece like this, you would find just about every interpretation of it that you could imagine, from, as you say, sort of the approach of a sacred piece done in a church setting in a more traditional church way, as opposed to a more operatic style musically and everything dynamically. I think you could find examples of all of it, and I think that's one of the really cool things about the piece. The interpretation is left up a bit to the performer and the performers and the conductor. And so I have happened to come from a more operatic background. But then again, I've also sung a fair amount of Lieder, as I was alluding to that aspect of it earlier. I think that I like the operatic side of it a little bit more, the more dramatic side of the piece.
It is a very dramatic work. It has the scenes in it, the scene between the widow and Elijah and him raising the son from the dead. And then when he calls the heavens to rain, it's in the wonderful scene. And when he confronts Ahab, when Jezebel kind of gets the crowd wound up to go and slay Elijah and so on. When I was in Texas, they actually did a production of it where they did stage it. It was, it's interesting. I prefer it not staged, but it does have that operatic element to it. The chorus had to memorize all the music, and that they didn't like particularly.
No, they weren't enthusiastic about that, huh?
No.
But that sort of made an idea come up in my mind, that maybe one of the reasons you don't do as much oratorio is because you have to stay still. You're standing and singing. Where nowadays, when you go to these operas, there's much activity.
Maybe we should learn a bit in the opera world from the oratorio world and stand a bit more and sing. I don't know. Some of the performances I think we revere the most in history are by performers that got awfully good at standing and being still and singing.
It says in your bio, Scott, that Falstaff is one of your favorite roles.
Uh-huh.
Living in New York, did you see the new production of that at the Met?
No, I did not. I did a couple of them myself this year, so I may not even have been around.
Getting back to Elijah, you are doing it in the church up on Cantrell, aren't you, Kent?
It's at Christ the King, which is on Rodney Parham, just off of Cantrell.
Right. And I think you've been there at least once before, haven't you, with the chorus?
We've done three there. We did Creation there, and then last year we did the Mozart Coronation Mass, and then this year the Elijah.
And is it very responsive acoustically for you?
Oh, I like it a lot. It's a beautiful sanctuary. It's quite live, and there's enough space. There isn't a great deal extra space, but we'll cram everybody in there, and then there's a good seating for the audience. It kind of wraps around. It's kind of like a thrust almost stage, if you will, and so everybody has a good seat.
So are you augmenting your singers for this, or will you just bring up your choir from Monticello and have them added to the Choral Society here?
That's right. I'll have the UAM choir and then the Choral Society.
And then you have what sort of access to rehearsal the week of?
We'll have everybody together on Monday and then again on Thursday and then the performance on Friday.
So your stars will come in on the Monday to sing with you?
They'll be there on Monday, yeah.
The other singers, soloists, they all have a pretty operatic background too, don't they?
They do, yeah. Sergio has been singing in Knoxville, and I think Linda just won or placed highly in the regional Met auditions. I think that was, last month or something they had those. And Diana sang with the New York City Opera for a while and then has been not singing professionally for a while, just kind of she takes on an engagement every now and then.
Mm-hmm. Have you actually sung with any of them, Scott?
Well, no, I know Diana, but I've not sung with the other two people. Sergio and I must have crossed paths, or crossed like ships in the night anyway at Knoxville, because I've sung there a number of times, but I've not sung with him. And Linda, I don't know the other person. Who's the other person, Ken?
Linda Barnett, although at the time her name was Reamer. You know, when we did La Fanciulla, she did the student performances of Minnie.
Oh, then I definitely met her for sure.
Yeah, right.
You know, I never sung with her. Some new colleagues that I've met.
Yeah.
It happens fairly often, for sure.
But in this, the baritone, the Elijah, is the one main character who you hear all the way through.
The other soloists actually kind of play different parts. Elijah is Elijah all the way through. The soprano is at some points an angel, and the alto is an angel, and she's also Jezebel and so on. But Elijah is Elijah from beginning to end.
So I love the baritone voice. And there's one baritone aria in Boheme, the coat aria that Colline sings. And for me, I judge the baritone on stage by the way he sounds compared with the cello that accompanies him. And when you can hardly tell t'other from which, to me that's perfect. It just is a wonderful, wonderful connection of those two voices that is remarkable.
You know, in the big aria that Elijah sings, the "It Is Enough," it's paired with a with cello.
Ah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, the composer knew his onions, as they say.
<That's right.
laughs> Being, as you said, Scott, more of a leader composer for the voice than anything bigger, he didn't write any operas, did he?
Yeah, he did write at least one, if I'm not mistaken. Because the librettist for Elijah is the same librettist. If I'm not mistaken, I read that. Is that right, Kent?
I believe that's correct, yeah. I don't think
it's
an opera that's very well known.
So, in fact, it was an opera that would have been written before Elijah. So I don't remember the title off the top of my head, but certainly it wasn't something that he was known for. But
it's almost a pity you sort of twitch a bit and think, why not? Why? What happened to that piece? Because he was such a popular composer. Anyway, all these things considered, you will be here quite soon. Just a warning, Scott, have you ever been to Little Rock before?
I have.
Have you sung in Little Rock before?
No.
Because at certain times of the year, there's a lot of pollen which does devastating damage to the performance of singers if they are.
I've been in that area, so I'm familiar with that a little bit. So I'll be guarding. Talk to you soon, Kent.
All right, Scott. Good to talk to you.
Okay, you too.
Bye now.
Goodbye, both of you.
Goodbye.
Dr. Kent Skinner, director of the Arkansas Choral Society and choral activities at the University of Arkansas Monticello. And Scott Bearden, baritone, who will sing the title role. The Choral Society will perform Mendelssohn's oratorio Elijah with baritone Scott Bearden, soprano Linda Barnett, alto Diana Seleski, and tenor Sergio Cepeda. 7:30 p.m. Friday, April the 25th, at Christ the King Catholic Church, 4000 North Rodney Parham Road. For tickets, call 501-8484 or visit www.lovetosing.org. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.